When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
So I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection.
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes, I killed Ned Thompson. I killed him.
You're out of order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 288. That seems like some significant number we should comment on. I guess that's just 12 squared times 2, which means what? What does it all mean, Andrew? What does it all mean? Here we go. It means we are...
You are my nephew's cousin's brother's former roommate.
And it means we're talking about some various things. Well, first, let's ask, how are you doing, Andrew Torres?
I am fantastic. How are you, Thomas?
Doing great. I'm excited for today's show. We are talking about something that I saw on Twitter. It made a little bit of news, but this kind of this weird situation with Kavanaugh and someone who maybe did him a favor and maybe got a favor for their daughter. We'll see how that shapes up. I'm also seeing in the main segment Led Zeppelin on Bonk, which I don't remember that album. But I'm sure it rocked. Led Zeppelin's on Bonk. Was it before Physical Graffiti or I don't know. Either way, we're going to return to that. I mean, that was a lot of fun back when we did that music episode that I'm sure you will be referencing. So excited to talk Zeppelin anytime. And then finally, we've got a little bit of Andrew was wrong. We'll see how significant that was. It's always fun to. As a listener and as your co-host, we all get to feel better about our intellect by dwelling on how wrong you were about some meaningless thing. So that's always fun. All right, that's our episode today.
Thanks for that intro, Thomas.
Yeah, how about
love
we
show?
How about we get started?
Yeah, let's get
he
into
had
it.
Had one beer at the party and had beers with, and having some beers with friends. Or just to meet up and have some beers. Drinking beer, which I gladly do. I like
you
beer.
You have answered that.
I like beer. I don't know if you do.
Okay.
Do you like beer, Senator, or not? What do you like to drink?
Next one is...
Senator, what do you like
Judge,
to drink?
Have
In
you...
In any event, we drank beer and still do. So, whatever.
So, yeah. A little bit of... So, I saw this and I kind of sent it to you because I'm wondering how much there is. So, tell us about this Brett Kavanaugh... situation.
Yeah. Okay. So this starts off with a Yale law professor, somebody who sits on the clerkships committee at Yale Law School. Her name is Amy Chua. And this part, nothing wrong. She is also a celebrated author. She wrote a book in 2011 called Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mom. That is what it sounds like.
Okay.
And it, you know, talks about how she parented her kids. And look, there is nothing wrong. Like when I'm about to criticize Chua, when we criticize Dershowitz or whatever, there's nothing wrong with being a law professor and also being a famous person. In fact, being a law professor, right? You know, I mean, look, we had Lawrence Lessig on the show, right? He ran for president, right?
It's what we all get into it for.
Yeah, often leads to being a famous person. Mm-hmm. So I can't say I've read the book. I try and parent in such a way as to diminish, you know, to work at counter purposes
I'm
to my type
A
personality.
I'm more of a wine mom myself. But sure, Tiger Mom, that's fine too.
Oh, I am totally a wine mom.
I'm a wine mom, 1,000%. Yeah.
So all that's fine. So what's not fine is the op-ed that Amy Chua wrote in the Wall Street Journal, July 12th, 2018, called Kavanaugh is a Mentor to Women.
Yeah.
And so.
All right, Tiger Mom.
It's gross, okay? And I'm going to just read part of it, right? Because how much of this is blocking a known weakness is something that you're going to have to decide as a listener for yourself. So it begins, okay, we're about to discuss Brett Kavanaugh. I'd like to discuss a less well-known side of the Supreme Court nominee, his role as a mentor for young lawyers, particularly women. The qualities he exhibits with his clerks may provide important evidence about what kind of justice he would be. And then she discloses up front, last year, my daughter accepted an appellate clerkship from Judge Kavanaugh, which was set to begin next month. Okay, so let's explain that. Amy Chua's daughter, Sophia, was in Yale Law School, was about to graduate, and had a clerkship with the D.C. Circuit with then Judge Kavanaugh of the D.C. Circuit. There was this disclosure up front in the article that said, hey, you know, my daughter applied for a whole bunch of clerkships and she was accepted to clerk for Judge Kavanaugh. Keep in mind that as somebody who went through this process, when you are at an Ivy League law school, when you're at any law school, you apply to clerkships even with judges with whom you disagree ideologically, right? A clerkship on the D.C. Circuit, particularly a clerkship with Brett Kavanaugh. I guess what I'm saying here is if I were in law school at the time, I absolutely would have applied to clerk for Brett Kavanaugh. Of course you would. Okay. Mm-hmm. So nothing so far, nothing untoward about that. Then she talks about the clerkship process. She says, I think this is really deceptive. Many judges use ideological tests in hiring clerks. That statement, as far as I can tell, is 100% false. I have said on this show on multiple occasions, I clerked for the most conservative judge on the Maryland Court of Appeals. Lots of people I know clerk for judges for whom they disagree ideologically. And the higher the level of judge, right, the closer that judge is to the Supreme Court, and certainly when the judge is on the Supreme Court, the less they give a damn about a 23-year-old, 24-year-old, 26-year-old clerk's opinions, right? I can promise you, and for good reason, right? Like, when you are just out of law school, you know nothing. What every judge I have ever met, left, right, and center, uses is an intelligence test for hiring their clerks, right? Certainly some judges self-select out, right? I did not apply when I was in law school. I did not apply to be to clerk for Antonin Scalia, right? I can't promise that if I had filled out the application and somehow he had wanted to take me, I certainly would have jumped at the chance to be a Scalia clerk. I didn't put myself in that position. So there is some self-selecting, but I don't know any judge that.
You're talking the other way though. So you're saying most students or whatever, potential clerks aren't going to do an ideological test, and that makes sense. But like, what about the other way? Do the judges care one way or the other? And you said they want to test intelligence, but so you've never heard of any judge that you know of making some sort of ideological test for a clerk,
right? Because think about the role of the clerk. The role of the clerk is to research And depending on how active the judge is, either to write the first drafts of opinions in some cases, or to write bench memos that become the first drafts of opinions in other cases. My judge was very much the latter. He wrote his opinions. And so I, as a clerk, delighted in writing bench memos and seeing when my original words made it into the opinions. Other judges do it in different ways, but in both cases, right, the person making the decision is the judge,
right?
Not the, you know, kid fresh out of law school. So then there's a bit that says Kavanaugh does not do that. He actively seeks out clerks from across the ideological spectrum who will question and disagree with him. If true, great. My judge did that. So that I'm not suggesting that that's not laudable, but I am suggesting that the first part of that, I think, is misleading.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're racially, ethnically diverse. More than half have been women. In the past decade, I have helped place 10 Yale Law School students with Judge Kavanaugh, 8 of them women. I recently emailed them to ask about their clerkship experiences. They all responded almost instantaneously. They cited his legendary work ethic, parenthesis, quotes, "He expected us to work really hard, but there was always one person working harder than us, the judge. His commitment to excellence," quote, "He wants every opinion that comes out of his chambers to be perfect. It is not uncommon to go through 30 to 50 drafts. His humility," quote, "He can take a great joke as easily as he can land one," which that
I thought I was going to say, nobody is more humble than
yeah. "And his decency. I've never seen him be rude to anyone in the building." That also, I think, has not aged well. This paragraph is also incredibly misleading. Nobody involved in this process would ever poll a clerk to ask that clerk what they think about their judge. I've talked about this, and in fact, I can confirm this from my debate with Justin Walker, also a Kavanaugh clerk, which you may recall occurred the day of the explosive Christine Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh hearing. And I pulled him aside and I said, look, notwithstanding the fact that also, you know, this just broke right beforehand, I'm not going to discuss any of the personal aspects because the relationship between a law clerk and a judge is intense, right? Here is somebody who is at the apex of the profession that you are just beginning, right? And every person I know who's ever clerked for a judge, even under intolerable conditions, comes out of it going, I would take a bullet for that guy, or gal, right? I certainly felt that way about Judge Radowski, who, you know, like I said, was the most hidebound conservative on the court, who I was not successful at changing his mind on any cases, although I tried, because here was somebody who made it to the very top, and I was 21, 22 years old, and he was willing to have me in his chambers and have me make my arguments, right? And that level of respect to somebody who's done the thing that you want to do, it's almost impossible for anything to overcome that, right? So every clerk I have ever met has that same outlook. Mm-hmm. And there is no way that Amy Chua doesn't know that, right? That when you go fishing for former clerks, you're going to get compliments. That's the way it works. It also, parenthetically, is why anytime you have seen anything to the contrary, that throws up the reddest of red flags, right? There were really terrible allegations against, and I'm not going to repeat. I'm not going to repeat the judge. Some judges who have stepped down, who, as soon as that came out, that there were allegations by former clerks, you were like, oh well, to overcome that hurdle, in addition to everything else, is just any lawyer would look at it and go, wow, that must be atrocious. Okay, so then there's a little bit, you know, to a person, they described his extraordinary mentorship. Then last two paragraphs, these are the important parts. "These days, the press is full of stories about powerful men exploiting or abusing female employees. That makes it even more striking to hear Judge Kavanaugh's female clerks speak of his decency and his role as a fierce champion of their careers. If the judge is confirmed, my daughter will probably be looking for a different clerkship. But for my own daughter, there is no judge I would trust more than Brett Kavanaugh to be, in one former clerk's words, a teacher, advocate, and friend. Okay. So
was that an attempt to say, like, look, this is against our interest because if he's confirmed, then she's out of a job kind of thing? Was that that attempt?
It's an attempt at sort of blocking out of like, hey, I'm not just putting out this puff piece on Kavanaugh because he hired my daughter. Because, you know, look, like now if he gets confirmed, you know, she'll be out of a job, which is not remotely correct. Like, you know, she immediately when Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court, got a job clerking for Judge Grant on the D.C. Circuit. So so didn't hurt Sophia at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say her name is Sophia Chua Rubenfeld. Amy Chua is married to Jed Rubenfeld. But when this opinion came out, Ely Mistal at Above the Law took note of it, right, and wrote an article for Above the Law that that basically said, look, like, this seems like an awfully weird defense of Brett Kavanaugh, right? Again, right, he's a Yale guy, but to have the Yale head of clerkship, or somebody who's on the Yale clerkship committee, whose daughter was offered a clerkship by Kavanaugh, to be out there promoting Kavanaugh, just looks kind of icky, right? And here's where the story develops. Both Amy Chua and her daughter then sort of vociferously insisted that there was no pending quid pro quo. So I'm gonna list. This has not been deleted as of today. I wouldn't be surprised to see this tweet get deleted. But Sophia Chua Rubenfeld has not tweeted in a year. Her last tweet was to Ely Mistal, who said, "Hi, daughter here. Just to clarify your post, I was college ROTC, attended YLS, Yale Law School, on Army Ed delay, education delay, and am joining active duty JAG after circuit clerkship, wherever that will be. Won't be applying to SCOTUS anytime soon because I will be in the Army. Proud of my brave mom as always, SCR." Okay, so no quid pro quo, except that 2 days ago, Brett Kavanaugh announced his clerks, and each Supreme Court justice gets two clerks, and you will be surprised, or not at all surprised, it's not you,
not me,
but 50% of them are Sophia Chua Rubenfeld. Now look, again,
was that one person, or did she split off and half of her is in each of the two? I'm just a technical clarification.
No, that is still one person.
Okay, just make it. Yeah.
The other person is Trenton Van Oss, who's a Harvard 2017 grad who also clerked for Judge Grant. Look, I want to steel man this really, really quickly. It is very common when a sitting judge is elevated to the Supreme Court for that judge to go back and get their clerks to whom they had previously extended offers. Okay, there is absolutely nothing untoward about that part. There is nothing untoward about a Yale law graduate with impeccable credentials becoming first a D.C. circuit court clerk and then becoming a clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court. There is something untoward about the fact that there are 18 of these jobs in the entirety of the country, right? It is so competitive, right, that people who are top five Harvard, Yale, Stanford routinely don't get these clerkships.
Yeah, I mean, there's only 18.
That there are very, very few. And then there's a little bit more in the story. Immediately after the first Wall Street Journal op-ed came out, The Guardian, again working with Ely Mistal, uncovered a really, really unsavory and gross story. About, and here I'm just going to read a little bit from The Guardian. A top law professor at Yale Law School, who strongly endorsed Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh as a mentor to women, privately told a group of law students last year that it was, quote, not an accident, end quote, that Kavanaugh's female law clerks all, quote, looked like models, end quote, and, again, Amy Chua here, would provide advice to students about their physical appearance if they wanted to work for him, The Guardian has learned. Yale provided Kavanaugh with many of the judge's clerks over the years, and Chua played an outsized role in vetting the clerks who worked for him, but the process made some students deeply uncomfortable.
Wow.
One source said that in at least one case, a law student was so put off by Chua's advice about how she needed to look and its implications that she decided not to pursue a clerkship with Kavanaugh, a powerful member of the judiciary who had a formal role in vetting clerks who served in the U.S. Supreme Court. In one case, Jed Rubenfelt, that's Amy Chua's husband, also an influential professor at Yale, told a prospective clerk that Kavanaugh liked a certain, quote, look. He told me, and this is a quote from the unnamed student, "You should know that Judge Kavanaugh hires women with a certain look," one woman told The Guardian. He did not say what that look was, and I did not ask. Chua's response to those allegations was not exactly a denial, she said. For more than 10 years that I've known him, Judge Kavanaugh's first and only litmus test in hiring has been excellence. That would be it. So, look, I don't want to say that this was a left-leaning, a pair of left-leaning law professors who are personally friends with Brett Kavanaugh fronting, right, trying to get out in front in July on impending problem, right, knowing that there were going to be issues with Brett Kavanaugh and women. July is certainly well before Christine Blasey Ford came forward. So let me be clear. We do not have the evidence to suggest that. Okay. It is certainly reasonable to say, oh, well, look, like, I am a prominent liberal woman law professor. I also want to just write an editorial that is pro Kavanaugh. And a unique turn on that is to point out, like, you know, that he's had a lot of female clerks. I know, because I've placed them, right?
Well, and her daughter was already working for him.
Right. And that's the crux. So everything you see, right, is this a quid pro quo paying back? It isn't. Okay. Is this a crime? It isn't. But is this an example of the continuing example of the Jimmy Carter, they made me sell my peanut farm? It absolutely 100% is.
Well, and it is an example of just how power, you know, allows often bad men to get away with stuff, even in ways that you wouldn't think, which is here's essentially maybe possibly an accomplice in some of his bad behavior in some ways. I mean, if she's, you know, like warning or helping a potential clerk say, like, here's the look he's going for. I mean, it just shows you how bad this recipe is for corruption when it's a powerful, bad person.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And to me, that the second half of that story is If I were Brett Kavanaugh here, you can't hire the clerk, right? Like, you write a nice letter back, you know, to Amy Chua, to Sophia Chua Rubenfeld, and you say, hey, you're absolutely qualified, and I'm really, really sorry. I want to avoid anything that could be portrayed as an appearance of impropriety. I have recommended to all of my fellow justices on the bench, hey, they should hire you. I will continue to advocate for you. You are a brilliant and talented young woman, but I don't want to do anything that could even be perceived as an appearance of impropriety, right? That's the standard that a Supreme Court justice ought to hold themselves to. Now, are they required? They're not, absolutely not required. Like, Clarence Thomas can go speak before the Federalist Society three times a week if he wants to, and he does. There is nothing, because there's no court above the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
There is nothing to prohibit Supreme Court justices from behaving however they want to behave, you know, short of impeachment. But John Roberts issued a report in 2012 urging that the Supreme Court voluntarily abide by the federal ethics guidelines. This would not pass the federal ethics guidelines. I don't know that it would be sanctionable, but it absolutely has the appearance of a conflict of interest. You cannot have somebody pen a visible, a New York Times bestselling author and, you know, the somebody who is in charge of the clerkship's office at Yale publicly come out and contribute to you getting your job and then have it look like you're paying them back. That I don't know anybody, right? If you replaced this, right, with bare bones facts, and you replace the Republicans with Democrats, I don't know any Republican that would sign on to it, right? So, you know, so there have been typical discussions kind of in the blogosphere. There are certainly people that have taken it way too far, right? This is not Brett Kavanaugh isn't going to be impeached over this, right? Even if the ethics guidelines applied, right? When I said it would not pass the ethics guidelines, that would mean, you know, maybe you would write a disciplinary letter. Right? Yeah. Like, this is not something for which.
Well, what about the ethics for Amy Chua though? Is there some? Do you know anything at all about that side of things? I mean, as a professor, right? Doesn't she have some ethical obligations?
Yeah, I don't know. I took a look for this, and I don't know, and perhaps it's just that Yale does not make it public, but I looked up their code of ethics and conflict of interest for law professors. They have to have one, right? Because there's no, as we've talked about with Elizabeth Warren, right? Like, there's no bar on practicing for clients while serving as a professor at Yale, but I can't find any published materials on that.
I just want to know what happened to her daughter's army plans. Shouldn't she be reporting for duty? She should be a JAG, right?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah. Kind of weird how the opportunity to clerk on the Supreme Court. I mean, look, and again, let's steel man it, right? If you're lifelong, if you're like, okay, well, I'm going to carve out this niche, I'm going to be a JAG. And then someone's like, well, how'd you like to, you know, be a Supreme Court clerk instead? Like, you say yes, right?
Yeah,
right?
No, I don't totally blame her, but she seemed very sure that this was, she lied.
Yeah.
Do you think she had no idea that she was going to get?
Yeah, absolutely. When you say won't be applying to SCOTUS anytime soon because I'll be in the Army.
She said she wouldn't even be applying. Okay. Yeah. No, yeah. I do blame her. Yeah.
Yeah.
She lied. All right. Well, so there's nothing that's going to happen, but this is very unethical. Is that the answer?
Yeah, that's exactly. Okay. And again, I've seen some discussion of, you know, is it criminal? Is it impeded? It absolutely is not any of that. It's why I wanted to walk through the story. Yeah. It is, you know, people in positions of power, behaving in ways that are gross and inappropriate, but not criminal. Nothing will happen. But it's a sad story.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Paint Your Life. I am still blown away by the painting that we had done from this. Now, I had it done for Lydia as a surprise. It's a beautiful painting of Lydia on the beach with Phoebe, and it is just absolutely stunningly beautiful. It exceeded my expectations. Lydia was blown away. She loves it. It's going to be something we have in our home forever because it's beautiful, and I can't wait to do the same thing with little Arlo. So here's how it works. Go to paintyourlife.com. They will take any photo you have. Could be a pet, could be your spouse, could be baby Phoebe with my wife. Well, no, probably not that. That's probably just me, but something like that. And it just any picture, and they will turn it into a beautiful, hand-done, world-class painting. This makes a fantastic gift for anything. Could be a birthday coming up, maybe an anniversary. Ooh, this would be a really good anniversary gift. You have to choose a good picture, but they will do the rest. They will turn it into a beautiful painting, and there's no risk. If you don't love your final painting, your money is refunded. It's great for decor. It's a work of art, and with Paint Your Life, you get your favorite memories transformed into a work of art that will be cherished forever. I keep talking about gifts. This does make a fantastic gift, but maybe you just want it for yourself. You might want a gift for yourself. That's, of course, an option too. And right now, there's a limited time offer. You get 30% off your painting. That's right, 30% off and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word OA, so just the letters OA, to 484848. That's OA to 484848. One more time, text OA to 484848 and message and data rates may apply, but go get that offer. This is seriously a beautiful gift. You will not regret it. All right. Well, with that said, I think it's time to rock on over to Led Zeppelin's On Bonk album.
Have you seen the bridge?
I have seen the bridge.
Where's that confounded bridge?
Are you going to sing it for us?
My third favorite album.
Yeah. Right?
So, yeah. No, we covered the suit by the estate of Randy California of the band Taurus. Which, you know,
yeah, P. Andrew Taurus.
new favorite band. The song is Taurus. The band was Spirit.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Right. So band Spirit performing that magnum opus Taurus, which is alleged to have inspired the iconic riff from Stairway to Heaven. We did that in episode 236. If you have not listened to episode 236, go back and do that. Thomas plays guitar. It's awesome. I'm really proud of that episode. And we had a lot of fun doing it. We mentioned at the time that the Ninth Circuit issued an opinion that had, in effect, two parts to that holding, right? And one part was that the trial court erred in its jury instructions related to copyright, and in particular, that those jury instructions should have told the jury that they can find copyright infringement related to an original arrangement of non-protectable elements, right? So in other words, right, you can't copyright B flat, right? But you can copyright an arrangement of otherwise non-copyrightable elements, right? And alternatively, that they could find copyright infringement for a combination of common musical elements, such as descending chromatic scales, arpeggios, or even short sequences of three notes, right? Mm. And it is the descending chromatic scale that is alleged to be similar between Taurus and Stairway. Yeah. Right. Because of that part of the finding, Randy California gets a new trial. Right. And we talked about that. The other part of the holding we touched on, it went the other way. And it was that the copyright itself extended to only the deposit copy. Right. That is the sheet music that was filed with the copyright office. Right. And there was, you and I went back and forth. We actually had some
really
listeners chime
this.
In.
Yeah.
Yeah. You and I went back and forth. Some of the listeners chimed in. The deposit copy contained both the bass clef and the treble clef. Right. But other versions, and these are versions that Led Zeppelin's attorneys have described in their pleadings as being bootlegs of concerts or studio bootlegs, contained only the bass clef. They excluded the treble clef. And apparently, from reading between the lines, nobody has said this exactly like this, but I think I now understand that if you look at the full sheet music and you play the full sheet music, you get more differences between Taurus and Stairway. But if you only play the bass clef, right, if you sort of give a minimal version of the song, then it sounds more like Stairway, right? I think that's the way it is.
But no, because this is what threw me off, because that makes sense, except then that argument goes the other way, right? Because okay.
Because what Randy California wanted to do was play only the bass clef version for the jury, and the judge required that he play the full deposit copy, right? So one of the asserted errors on appeal by Randy California was, I should have been able to play all the versions. And the Ninth Circuit said, no, look, like, your copyright extends to the deposit copy, to the full sheet music as on file with the copyright office, and not to all of the potential versions and variants that might be played with it.
Now, you're confusing me. So Randy California, who's dead, his estate would want to just play the bass clef because,
correct.
Yes. Now you're saying that Led Zeppelin won. Album Led Zeppelin won. No, sorry. Yeah. Led Zeppelin WON won this thing. But they're saying the improper part of it, or the part of the jury Was this part of the jury instructions or part of this was something else?
This is a separate part of the appeal. Thing. So Led Zeppelin won on that at trial, and they won on that at on appeal.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say. Right. So in other words, the Ninth Circuit's ruling granted Randy California a new trial, but also ruled in favor of Led Zeppelin on the deposit copy issue.
Okay. Make sense? They do have to still. So despite the fact that they're getting another trial, they do still have to play the full thingy. They can't just isolate the bass clef.
Yes. Okay. Yes, exactly right. So that was the state of the law as of December of 2018. Here we need a quick Andrew was wrong. I missed this. I thought that only Led Zeppelin had moved for rehearing en banc. Okay. And the reason for that is because it's absolutely insane for the estate of Randy California to have moved for rehearing en banc. Sure. And the reason for that is you got your new trial, right? Like I get you didn't get everything you wanted. But if you move for rehearing en banc, then as we're about to find out, the court assumes jurisdiction over the case and you might lose on the thing that sent you back, right? Like it absolutely did not occur to me, and it was on the third page of the docket, and I just didn't see it, that Randy California, so that both parties moved for rehearing en banc. That's crazy. But nevertheless, despite the fact that the court sort of sat on that motion for 6 months, you know, keep that in mind, by the way, you know, when we go back and we talk about the relatively slow pace of you know, the Mueller investigation and the now pending court cases and everything that we talk about with respect to Donald Trump, where you're like, wow, gosh, that was, you know, 6 weeks ago and nothing has happened. Right. Led Zeppelin couldn't get the Ninth Circuit to move in consideration for this order without waiting 6 months. So, you know, that our courts move slowly.
If a British band from 40 years ago can't get it to move.
If Led Zeppelin, oh, come on, you cannot tell me that the entirety of the Ninth Circuit, right? Like, that is appellate judges. I bet Led Zeppelin has a 100% approval rating among appellate judges. So, okay, on June 10th, a couple of days ago, in just a one-line ruling, the Ninth Circuit granted en banc review. So, again, what does that mean? The Ninth Circuit ruling we were talking about was a three-judge panel, as is commonplace on U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeal. When you petition for en banc review, that means you are saying that this represents a new or unsettled area of law. And so instead of it just being a panel to decide it, it should be decided by the entire circuit court here, the entire Ninth Circuit. I want to make a prediction that could never possibly be verified, and that is if this lawsuit did not involve Led Zeppelin, there is zero chance that the court would have granted an en banc review. But it does, so they did. Then the very next day, the attorneys for the estate of Randy California filed a letter seeking clarification of the scope of the en banc review. And again, this is just, as far as I can tell, a plain misreading of the law. Right. Huh. So I'm going to read a little bit from the letter. And again, they just sent a letter to the court and they said, both appellant Michael Skidmore, that is the trustee for the Randy California estate, and the Led Zeppelin appellees filed for rehearing en banc. Appellant Skidmore filed for rehearing on a single narrow issue of national importance, the deposit copy issue. Right. That the one we just explained. While the appellee's petition asked for reconsideration on all the many discrete legal and factual issues on which the panel ruled against them. Ninth Circuit Rule 35-2 provides that where a party petitions for hearing or rehearing en banc, the court will not order hearing or rehearing en banc without giving the other parties an opportunity to express their views about whether such hearing is appropriate. No party has the ability to answer a petition for rehearing unless expressly authorized by the circuit. The circuit court ordered Led Zeppelin to answer appellant Skidmore's petition for rehearing on the deposit copy issue, and it was briefed. The circuit, however, never ordered Skidmore to respond to any issue in the Led Zeppelin appellee's petition for rehearing or any other matter in this case. So the argument from the letter is, therefore, we want clarification that this en banc appeal is only going to be confined to the deposit copy issue. The next day, the Ninth Circuit said, no, that's not the way any of this works.
Oh, so does that explain why the Randy California people went for the en banc thing? They misunderstood, like, what it was for? Is that what happened?
I think they did. So I'm going to get to that in a minute. But first, let's explain how they're wrong, okay? So the Ninth Circuit issued a single one-paragraph opinion in which they said, when we take a case en banc, that's jurisdictional. We get the whole case. So you can't tell us that we can't rule against you on the stuff you want. What they say is, in order to clarify the scope of en banc hearing, rehearing in these cases, and then they're quoting from a previous case, when a case is heard or reheard en banc, the en banc court assumes jurisdiction over the entire case, regardless of the issue or issues that may have caused any member of the court to vote to hear the case en banc. Although the en banc court may, in its discretion, choose to limit the issues it considers, the en banc court is under no obligation to do so, period. And that's it. And that's the court's way of telling Randy California, no, we're gonna reconsider the entire case. Hmm. How did this happen? I suspect what happened is that Randy California's lawyers are trial court attorneys. They're not accustomed to appellate practice. As far as we can tell, they're pretty good trial court attorneys, right?
But do they specialize in rock law?
Well, now they do.
Yeah.
If you don't have that as your, you know, number one item on your bio, you're missing out on some marketing. And so the proper way to have dealt with this would have been to do what Led Zeppelin's lawyers did here, right? Which is wait for the other side to file their petition for rehearing en banc. And by the way, they filed on the same day, but Randy California filed his first, right, in the electronic filing system. And so what Led Zeppelin has said in response to the petition by Randy California for rehearing en banc is, yeah, en banc review is totally appropriate and warranted as to the issues raised by defendants below. But, and then this is their specific language, although defendants do not oppose rehearing as to all issues, the panel decision properly decided the deposit copy issue challenged by the petition of plaintiff below, Michael Skidmore. And then they sort of go through all of the reasons why they think the court should confine itself on that. That's what you do when, right, you've won on an issue and lost on an issue. Mm. And here, right, if you look at just the results, right, I get that they want to win on the deposit copy issue, but they now run the risk, and I think it is a very, very likely risk. I don't think the court would have taken this case en banc but for, like I said before, but for the fact that Led Zeppelin is one of the parties. And what I mean with respect to that is, but for the concern that you raised in our episode 236, right, which is this, are we opening the floodgates to everybody suing everybody in rock music, right? If we allow this to go forward, could this be, you know, wide-ranging and disaster? Okay, maybe we shouldn't change things, right? That is, and again, I'm reading between the tea leaves here. Other than that, this does not, I mean, this is a pretty straightforward and narrow set of issues related to copyright in music that would not command the full attention of the full Ninth Circuit. Hmm. So my prediction here, you know, Teresa, get your keyboard ready. I predict that the Ninth Circuit en banc is going to it's already vacated the panel decision, but they're going to affirm the district court's judgment, and Randy California and Spirit are going to miss out on their opportunity to retry the case. You know, could they have avoided this by not moving on their own for en banc reconsideration? I don't know, right? And maybe that's the other answer to this, right? Maybe their lawyers thought through all of this and said, yeah, you know what? Like, Led Zeppelin is definitely going to move for reconsideration en banc, so let's get out in front of it and try and characterize it our way because we're going to get it anyway. That seems like a tough judgment for me to take because circuits so rarely take a case on bunk, right? Like that is, it is just, it is a very, very rare occurrence. And you've got the brass ring.
Can you refresh us on why that's a rare occurrence? I'm having trouble remembering why, like what the significance of that is.
Yeah. For the same reason that it took the Ninth Circuit 6 months to rule on the motion, right? Our federal courts are understaffed, overworked. The dockets are huge. The caseload is huge. And you have to get everybody together from the entire circuit, right, to sit and hear a case on bonk. And some of those, right, the Ninth Circuit covers the West Coast, right? So you're going to have to, like, judges are going to have to fly in for the hearing, right? It is just, it is lengthy and inconvenient and time-consuming. And so only...
So, like, which party wants en banc and why? Like, I guess that's, sorry, I'm a little confused yep. on.
So, the reason that Led Zeppelin wants en banc, or ought to have wanted en banc, mm-hmm. and in fact moved, is because the panel decision ordered a new trial, right? They won a trial, and then they won in part but lost in part at the Ninth Circuit. So whenever that happens, and you're facing, if they did nothing,
oh, so then you say, let's get the full bench.
Yeah,
to...
you say no, we're not going to have a whole new trial here. Let's get the full bench. Right.
I see.
And that's why they moved for en banc reconsideration.
I gotcha. Okay.
I'm still baffled why Randy California moved for en banc reconsideration. You got your new trial, and if you had shut up and said nothing, maybe the Ninth Circuit would have been like, yeah, you know what? Like, we're gonna see how this develops, right? Go mm-hmm. back, have your new trial, get a more full record, and then we'll, you know, take another crack at this when you're back up here in a couple of years. I just don't get it.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying now. Yeah, this.
And I want to answer what really gave me pause is the letter citing the rule 35-2, right, which is the local rules about how these petitions get resolved, because it just seems to me to be a plain misreading of the local court rules, right? The part quoted in the letter says, where one party petitions for hearing or rehearing, the court will not order without giving the other parties an opportunity to express their views about whether a rehearing is appropriate. But Randy California already expressed those views, right? He moved, right, through his lawyers, the estate of Randy California, moved for rehearing en banc. So you don't have to poll them and say, do you think rehearing is appropriate? You've already said, yes, I think it is. I moved for it. And so, it's hard for me to get that. And so then basically their argument is a kind of, we were prejudiced by not getting a chance to reply to Led Zeppelin's request for rehearing en banc and say why that was not appropriate. And that's true. They didn't get that because they were out in front and because they moved first for rehearing en banc. So go back in time. And you know, this is steal the limited use time machine. If mm-hmm. you're attorneys for Randy California, go back in time. Don't let Led Zeppelin open for you. but failing that, if you do, when you get a partial victory in the Ninth Circuit, instead of moving for reconsideration en banc, instead wait, let Led Zeppelin do that, and then file a brief that kind of tracks what they said instead and be like, look, we think en banc is totally inappropriate here.
Yeah.
But if you are, right, the only thing the Ninth Circuit screwed up was this deposit copy issue. In fact, like we're so good, right, that there's an alternative way for us to go back down on trial, which is, the Ninth Circuit, the thing, we weren't going to mention this, but the Ninth Circuit got the deposit copy issue wrong. And then you have the opportunity to rebut all of the Led Zeppelin arguments on the jury instructions and tell the court in great detail why those aren't worthy of reconsideration en banc.
Wow. So somebody might have screwed up, maybe.
Somebody might have screwed up. You know, if the lawyer, you know, wants to contact us, I'd love to have him come on the show. I'd love to have him, tell us what he was thinking. This is Francis Alexander LLC, and the lawyers are Francis Malfoy and Alfred Joseph Fleur.
All right, well, that's AJ our rock Fleur. Law. That's our rock law segment, I guess, for this week. We need to make sure you have plenty of time to talk about why you were wrong. So does that wrap up our Led Zeppelin law?
That wraps us up.
Okay, good. Opening Arguments is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Look, we all know how hard it can be to find a new job. I remember when I was a kid looking for a job just to put myself through college. It was a nightmare. I mean, you had to like actually drive around to go look for places back then. You know, it was a different time. Anyway, what if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Well, now ZipRecruiter's technology can do that for you. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app, let it know what kinds of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone just like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know. So if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app. Our listeners should download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No. Andrew is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Well, let's move on to the Andrew is wrong. You saved it for last, which you don't normally do. So I'm curious why that is. It either means it's one way or the other. Is it like you're more wrong or you're just trying to shoehorn it into the end where you're slightly
wrong? I was trying to game the system so that because usually we run late and then we've got to punt the
season. Oh, no time. Yeah, we don't have enough time. Yeah.
Oh, look at the time. No, so in episode 286, I said that false answers to the census were perjury. That was too cavalier, right? It does not fall under the criminal perjury statute. It is not a felony. I didn't say that it was a felony. I was using perjury colloquially, but I shouldn't do that on a law show.
Right.
It falls under 13 U.S.C. Section 221, which specifically establishes a misdemeanor offense for either refusing to answer a valid census question, that is a $100 fine, or giving a false answer, that is a $500 fine. So refusing to answer census questions or falsely answering census questions is a crime. It is a misdemeanor. It is punishable by fines. It is not part of the criminal offense of perjury as a felony. I don't think that changes my analysis in any way, right? We're still talking about government officials showing up and prominent warnings of you must answer these questions as provided by law. There are criminal penalties if you fail to answer or if you answer incorrectly, which will be right, that legend will be imprinted on the census forms. So, and again, the importance of that is, right, you're talking about people who, you know, potentially people who are at the margins, who may have engaged or may have family members who have engaged in criminal conduct and for whom those threats are really, really salient. And look, we went through this. It's worth bearing again, if there are people listening to this episode that did not listen to 286. The Constitution requires you to count persons in this country, not citizens, not persons who are law-abiding, right? It requires you to count all persons. And this effort to deter certain persons because of their citizenship status is blatantly unconstitutional. But so, yes, it's still against the law. The threat is still real. The deterrent effect is still real. We know this because Thomas Hofeller said it, right? The Republicans themselves, you know, understand what the implication of asking this question is. But it is important to point out that those answers are not subject to penalty of perjury. And I was wrong on that.
Okay. Well, step one, you know, part one, I want to say I'm deeply disappointed that you got this wrong and I need you to clean up your act a little bit. But part two, because you're dragging down the show. I never say anything that's wrong. I'm always 100% right. So, you know, make sure you step up a little bit. But part two, I was just wondering, like, don't every 10 years a bunch of people not respond to the census? Like, so isn't, are we in a, I did a little Googling and I'm seeing that the Census Bureau has not prosecuted, the agency hasn't prosecuted anybody since 1970. So, yep, like, how,
nope.
Well, I was just going to ask, like, so is this the case? Is it a practicality thing where it's like, there, if they can't get you to respond to the census, then they, it's already hard enough to, like, prosecute you? Is that the answer?
Yeah. I'm really glad you asked the question because it helps me clarify something that I think I didn't say particularly well. There is no real risk. It's why it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, and again, I want to own up to being wrong, but it doesn't matter what the criminal penalties are, right? If it could be perjury, it could be the death penalty, right? Nobody gets prosecuted for falsely answering a census question. That is true. But what is also true is the cover to the census form will bear the legend in capital letters that says failure to answer these questions or answering these questions incorrectly can result, it is a violation of 13 USC 221 and can result in criminal penalties, right? Mm-hmm. It will say something like that. And the further you go into precisely the demographics that this is designed to deter people, for whom this is designed to deter responses, are the people who are least familiar with the justice system, or to the extent that they are familiar with the justice system, are familiar in a profoundly negative way, right? And so saying, hey, if you fill out this piece of paper and you lie, you're guilty of a crime is a strong incentive for those folks to be like, well, I never got that piece of paper. And again, we know that because Hofeller, that's the Republican operative's own studies show that, right? So it is, so the whole point of all of it is to deter. That deterrence will fall most heavily, not on listeners to the show. You guys know, again, don't take legal advice from a podcast, but you could take your census, right? You know, that nothing is going to happen to you if you falsely or fail to answer your census forms. I just made that, I just cracked the joke, but seriously, like, don't answer your census. Like, it's our listeners, it's super critical that you do that, right? And not, you know, fail to complete it or complete that incorrectly, because you will underrepresent precisely the number of precisely the kind of people that we don't need underrepresented in the next census. But yeah, you know, you're right. It's a toothless threat, but toothless threats dissuade people.
All right. Well, there you go. I hope you learned your lesson, Andrew.
I did. I will strive to be more like you in the future.
80% of our listeners just had a panic attack, but that's okay. All right, it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law, and I will start us off. Thank you to Donnie Hall, Patrick B. Rifle, something like that. Suleiman Basir, Quijibo James. Oh, Quijibo, like Simpsons reference, I'm hoping. Christy Ann Pierantoni. Andy Holt and Junk. Your turn, Andrew.
All right. Thank you to Joshua Farmer, to wishing Mitch McConnell an eternity of pee hole burn and diarrhea. All right. To a heartfelt apology to Heath Enright. Oh, I wonder who that is. Wow. To Leon Kassab, James Mudd, and finally, thank you to Larry Blahnik. And thanks to all of our patrons. And if you would like to join their ranks, you'd like a one-time shout-out, head on over to patreon.com/law. Sign up for as little as $1 an episode. You get all kinds of super cool stuff. The higher you go, the more cool stuff you get. But if you give us $1, we'll even read your Mitch McConnell taunts on the air.
No matter how, bathroom humory they are. Yeah. Okay, now it's time
I have no shame.
Yeah. Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Now it's time for TTTBE, the answer. This was a really hard one. I could see an argument for every single answer. No easy eliminations. So let's find out. How did I do?
All right. Yeah, this was the case of the National Park Service entering into a contract with a private citizen, an antique collector, to buy stuff in the city of a former president. And then according to the contract, the collector would buy the stuff and then sell them to the Park Service. The Park Service would reimburse him for the cost plus a 10% commission. Purchases by antique collectors ordinarily are subject to sales tax, but federal agencies, this fact was not given in the fact pattern, but you correctly inferred it, a federal agency such as the National Park Service is exempt from state sales tax, mm-hmm. right? So then the question is, the collector files a lawsuit to say, yeah, you can't to enjoin collection of the sales tax on his purchases for the Park Service, claiming that it is unconstitutional as applied to the Park Service, should the state court issue the injunction? Answers were, your answer A, no, because the purchaser of the antiques is the collector rather than the federal government. That's who's liable for the tax. That seems totally straightforward, but, you know, is it legally nuanced enough? We'll find out. B, no, because the suit is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. You almost immediately ruled out, and you were like, okay, I can kind of get it. That's a good elimination. Here, it is not clear that only the federal courts would have exclusive jurisdiction. This is, at its core, a contract dispute, and state and federal courts can have concurrent jurisdiction over the same case, right? So, in other words, this case, as filed, would be between the collector, the third party here, and
the state
board of taxation. And while it's possible that could get removed to federal court, like that's a state court issue. So not only is it not within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts, you would need more facts in the fact pattern for it to even be within the jurisdiction of the federal courts, and then it could be concurrent. So good elimination. That's right. Not it.
Okay.
C, yes, because the federal government is contractually obligated to pay the amount of the sales tax when the government covers the collector's cost of the antiques. Now, you ultimately said you had difficulty differentiating that C answer from the D answer, which has to do with the supremacy clause. So let me jump to D right away, which is, yes, because under the supremacy clause, the federal program to acquire the antiques preempts the state sales tax on the purchase of those items. We've talked about preemption on the show. The supremacy clause is the clause in the Constitution that says that that the U.S. government is the supreme law of the land, right? Mm-hmm. And so what that means is, on subjects where the state and the federal government differ, the federal government wins.
Right.
That is what we call preemption, right? And there are different flavors of preemption. We've talked about occupying the field, for example. But critically, what you would have to show is that the law, and here this is the law that allows the National Park Service to enter into the contract, would somehow conflict with the state sales tax law.
Oh, okay. So this is like way too overbroad.
Yes.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Saying, okay. I get you. I read it a little bit more, maybe too much in the context of the question. Yep. But yeah, now that I read it again, preempts the state sales tax on purchase of these items. So that doesn't just mean for this collector, that means for everybody.
It's tough to say exactly what it would mean, but whenever you see supremacy clause and preemption, you are talking about a law and not about a contract, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look back at the fact pattern doesn't even tell us what the underlying law is, right? It just says the National Park Service entered into a contract. And so the difference between C and D is C says that the obligation is contractual. D would say that the program is invalid because of the supremacy clause, because of the law. So D, good elimination. So now we get down to the meat of the question, A versus C, which is, hey, the collector is paying the sales tax, but then turning around and charging the federal government his costs, which include the sales tax.
Yeah.
So does that mean that the sales tax is imputed to the government, or does that mean that the sales tax falls upon the the individual. And you picked A, no, and that is correct.
Yeah. Okay, good. I was feeling more confident about this one because, like, when you talk about the cost, you know, there could be a billion different taxes involved in the cost of the collector. You know, like there could be any sort of other state taxes, state and local taxes. There could be all kinds of stuff. So it feels like it would be a little too far to say that just because the federal government is reimbursing them for costs, that that means they're like being subject to a tax like that. I could see that. Basically, I could see that principle being way too difficult to like carry out in practicality.
That is 100% the rationale. And in fact, there is a case to that effect, right?
That Andrew Seidel worked on. No, not
I
that
I think
part.
He did. Okay. Yeah, no, he probably did. He's worked on a lot of stuff. So, but yeah, no, that's exactly the right reasoning. That once you open up sort of Pandora's box of, well, this is only a cost because it was a tax, right? Like, then you just wind up in this minefield of, you know, okay, well, what if the regulation increases the cost?
Yeah, like the collector had to stop at a gas station on the way and they bought some gum and there's a state sales tax on the gum. So like that tax also is that kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly right. And great job parsing through.
And I'm going to go ahead and say I beat the entire Puzzle on a Thunderstorm team again, like because I'm sure they all. No, I'm just kidding. But let's pretend that they did. No, that's awesome. I'm really excited for this. That was a tough one. I feel like I was pretty right on. I did what I was saying about C&D is like if it was the supremacy clause, then I didn't understand the difference. But of course, if it wasn't the supremacy clause that was really at issue here, then which I don't think it was, right? Or are you saying it still is the supremacy clause that's at issue?
Oh no, like there's that's just a total red herring.
Okay, good. Yeah. So given that I didn't know that it was red, I couldn't differentiate between them. But yeah, knowing that, then okay. But that's awesome. I'm really excited. Hey, what's my percentage? I feel like I've been doing well recently. Am I giving?
Yeah, so you are now 75 for 130. You would think that would even out to, you know, a round number.
I guess not.
It's 57.6.
Not very good. I thought I was closer to, okay. All right.
It's okay. You're
never mind.
You're getting back.
I must have missed a bunch in a row or something because I thought I was already higher than that before I got these two right, but I guess I was wrong. Okay, well, let's hop in our limited use time machine. And Andrew, why don't you tell us who this week's winner of TTTBE is in addition to me?
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Thanos, the Hands of Fate, which is a fantastic name, who says, I'm also going with A. B seems like it doesn't fit. The federal government wouldn't be determining issues on state sales tax. C makes no sense. If the Fed is going to repay the taxes, preventing the payment of the tax doesn't work. Without knowing the S clause, A, then Fed pays. So congratulations, Thanos, and everyone give, that is at Yappa Podcast, a follow on Twitter, YAPPAPODCAST, and look for more great stuff from Thanos, the Hands of Fate. And congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Go check out Lot Awful Movies coming to a theater near a podcast stream near you. It's either already out or it's about to be out very soon. I promise one of those two things is true. And either way, you're going to want to head over to patreon.com/law and check it out. All right, we will see you for a Rapid Response Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.